Well, my next guest is no stranger to the show. He runs the very large website, dollarcollapse.com. It's filled with news and commentary on today's economic events. And John has been on the program several times. John, great to have you back on the program today.
Hey, Jerry. Great to be back.
Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about what you see in these markets. I know many people are getting skittish on stocks after a really nauseating run as we have gone higher, but really there's been not, aside from the fact that the Fed's pumping in money, there hasn't been a whole lot of fundamental reason to see stocks going up. But the other thing that we've seen is this stubborn increase in the 10-year yield, getting up near 3% as of late this week. What's your thoughts on both stocks and this interesting rise in the 10-year yield that we're seeing?
Well, to set the stage a little bit, the Fed has basically accomplished a lot of what it wanted to accomplish when it started just flooding the system with cash. It's ignited a couple of asset bubbles. Stocks have gone back up to all-time highs. The housing market is recovering nicely. And, you know, in some parts of the country now, we've got house prices back to their 2007 levels, you know, at the peak of the previous housing bubble. And that is beginning to translate into slightly faster economic growth. The banks are starting to lend again because they're seeing their customers become more creditworthy as their stock portfolios and home prices go up. So it looks like the economy is starting to find its footing. And now the Fed has to worry about these asset bubbles going parabolic, because they're still pumping huge amounts of cash into the market and causing inflation, but not inflation as we think of it normally, because it's not manifesting as a general increase in price levels. It's manifesting as asset bubbles, where all the money the Fed puts into the system go in specific hot areas. And in this case, it's stocks and houses. So the Fed wants to pull back, but because they've been using the money they've been pumping into the system to push down interest rates, they're pulling back. They're buying fewer government bonds would lead interest rates to go up pretty dramatically. And that's what we're seeing now. Interest rates are starting to spike. You know, the 10-year Treasury yield is over a full percentage point higher than it was 6 months ago. And that is destabilizing the markets, because we live in a variable rate world right now, where everybody has structured their financial lives to benefit from and depend on ever lower interest rates. You know, the governments of the world have financed themselves in the short term part of the market, because that's where rates are lowest, and that holds down interest costs. But let interest rates start going back up again, and you'll see Japan and the US and Europe have to roll over their debts at higher and higher rates, and they'll have to pay more in interest, and that'll blow out their budgets. And so the system will destabilize. And that's what we're grappling with right now. We've borrowed so much money that there's no pain-free solution, and there probably is no way for the Fed to get out of this. So what the stock market is doing now, it's coming off its highs, is reacting to the fact that rising interest rates are dangerous on a lot of different levels and make stocks a lot less attractive. And at the same time, we're seeing gold and silver bounce off their ridiculous bottoms, where they just got crushed lately, and they're going back up, either for just simple technical reasons, because precious metals have gotten slammed, and when something gets crushed in this way, it usually bounces back, because you've got a lot of people who are buying at the bottom, what they hope is bargain hunting. Or precious metals are reacting to the fact that we don't expect the government to be able to actually scale back the money that they're putting into the system. And when the stock market tanks because of higher interest rates, the government is going to have to take back its tapering talk and promise to continue quantitative easing forever. And that's phenomenally good for precious metals. So it could be that that's what the metals markets are now looking forward to 6 months down the road, when the whoever the Fed chairman is at the time steps up and says, listen, this tapering stuff, we'll delay it for a while, all right? Another 6 months of easy money. And at that point, precious metals would be expected just to take off. So we'd see asset bubbles blowing up everywhere, and one of them would be precious metals. So that's a general look at where we are today.
Now, the Fed, you mentioned the Fed cutting back, and our thesis, and I'm curious on how you're viewing this, because when I look at the Fed and I hear them say, oh, we're going to taper and we're probably going to do it soon, I think to myself that is an absolute positive dream, that is virtually impossible. Now, you could do it through sleight of hand. They could officially pull back the QE3 and say, oh, we're going to cut it by $20 billion, and now we're only pumping in $65 billion a month. You see, we cut it. But they could still be propping up the bond market because they're the lender of last resort, so they have to buy it if nobody else does. But the demand isn't really there globally for these bonds if the Fed does taper, say, next month, is it?
No. You're seeing Japan and China actually scale back their holdings of U.S. treasuries. And beyond that, there's really not that much demand out there in the world. The Fed has been doing most of the buying in the long-term treasury market. Because, think about it. Who would lend money to the U.S. at 3% for 30 years or 4% for 30 years or what, the 30-year bond is like 3.88% right now. That's an insanely bad idea. And everybody in the world gets that. So there isn't that much demand for long-term treasuries, and the Fed has to do most of the buying. And if they scale back their buying, then interest rates will have to go up. And everybody knows this. So the Fed's ideal course for this to follow would be for the economy to start growing organically and people beginning to demand more long-term treasuries because they're just getting richer and they have more money to invest, and that's one place they want to put their money, and that the economy begins to grow in a steady way. But that's highly unlikely because we have so much debt. This is not a normal world anymore because we now owe orders of magnitude more than we did 30, 40 years ago, especially when you include unfunded liabilities of Social Security and Medicare. And that means that we're extremely fragile and extremely unstable, and we can't expect, without extreme government help, for the economy to operate what we consider normally.
I guess the only thing that could happen, John, is we could see, because fiscal policy has really been muted in Washington, there really hasn't been anything that's been done as of late that has been real meaningful, that Keynesian type of fiscal policy that's supposed to synergize perfectly with, Keynesian monetary policy. The two aren't working together. It's been pretty much a one-legged stool with monetary policy trying to lead us into a recovery, and it can't. So I guess Washington could have some fiscal policy hit up its sleeve that it's going to unleash, but it seems as if a lot of the smart money out there is banking on a Fed taper. Do you think they're going to be wrong? Do you think we're going to see a taper before the end of the year?
Well, I think they're very likely going to try because they've got these asset bubbles that they're very worried about now. You don't want to see the housing market spike from here. We're already house prices are at record or near record levels in a lot of hot markets. You don't want to see it keep going because that destabilizes the rest of the economy in its own way. You don't want to see stock prices spike at a time when margin debt, in other words, people are borrowing to buy stocks, is already at record levels. These are pre-correction levels in these markets where they normally would turn down from here. So if the Fed kept on adding money to the system, you would see these markets or some other part of the leveraged speculating community just spike. The Fed is worried about that. They don't want to see destabilizing bubbles expand from here. So they have to try to taper. And in their fantasy world, the tapering is successful, but that's not this world. It's very, very unlikely that they're going to be able to stop or dramatically scale back their bond buying without interest rates spiking and without that destabilizing the world. So there's no way out when you borrow too much money. It works the same way for a country as it does for individuals and families. That if you borrow too much money, you lose control over your destiny because bad things start to happen, and any little blip in your fortunes is magnified by the fact that you owe so much money to so many people. And that's where we are as a society, not just the U.S., it's Europe and Japan and potentially China, even though we really don't know what China owes. But with the whole world this highly leveraged, any little blip, you know, a small spike in interest rates, if interest rates were to go back to just historically normal levels, back when we had a nice, steadily growing economy, we would see a crisis right now. So things can't return to quote-unquote normal, because normal is disastrous when we owe this much money. And we'll find that out in the next few years, and it's not clear how we find that out, because that depends on the decisions of individual people sitting around a table under huge amounts of pressure. And so we can't know what Janet Yellen or Lawrence Summers or whoever replaces Ben Bernanke are going to do exactly, but we know they're in an impossible situation, and that anything they do carries huge risks and is highly likely to be disastrously wrong, because that's the nature of extreme debt. You know, you reach a situation when you're borrowing and borrowing and borrowing, where anything you do is probably going to mess up your life. And it's not so much that decision as the previous decisions that have brought you to this place. And that's really where we are. So the next few years will be some kind of a disaster scenario, but it's not clear what kind, because we don't know what decisions these guys are going to make.
My guest today is John Rubino. He is the founder of DollarCollapse.com. He's also the author of the book, The Collapse of the Dollar and How to Profit from It. He co-wrote that book with James Turk of GoldMoney.com. John, let's go back to the idea of interest rates, because we had talked about how the 10-year yield had been creeping up. We had certainly seen a creeping up in mortgage rates over the last several months, and that has caused some concern about the overall housing recovery, quote-unquote. A recent headline showing that mortgage activity plunged by 50% over the last 3 months. And another headline that came out, and I did a little bit of research on this one, and I was really stunned. 50% of home sales occurring in the United States are occurring in cash. Now, that's been a trend for some time, but it seemed as if this housing recovery had some genuine green shoots, you know, coming out of it, and it appeared to be real. But what we're seeing right now is it appears as if we're beginning to see a slowdown in that. What's your thoughts on real estate? You've written a book on the topic. Do you think that we're going to see another crash like we did back in 2007, 2008, or do you think that any crash ahead will be more mild?
Well, I don't think that real estate is leading the way it did back in the early part of the aughts, and so it's not the epicenter. But it is definitely starting to become bubble-ish in some places. And because of that, you could see a dramatic reversal. If mortgage rates went back to just 6%, and you know, I remember bragging to a friend about getting a 6.5% mortgage decade and a half ago. You know, that was actually a good rate at one time. But if mortgage rates just go back to that level, you would see an absolute drying up of all the refi activity out there. And you would see a dramatic scale back in the number of people who can afford houses, because that, you know, effectively doubles your mortgage payments if mortgage rates go from the last year's low to 6.5%. And so fewer and fewer people will be able to buy houses. You'll see a dramatic slowdown, and that'll reverberate through the economy, because housing is a big part of the economy now. You know, the construction industry employs a lot of people. The mortgage banking industry generates a huge amount of taxable income, yada, yada. You know, so housing is potentially a leader on the downside when the turn comes, when interest rates spike to the point that it dries up housing. But there are lots of other places that could be more serious in the short run. You know, you've got China and Japan out there in very fragile states, and you could see them go into some kind of a crisis driven by debt and pull down the rest of the global financial system. Derivatives are insane right now. You know, interest rate derivatives are 3/4 of the $500 trillion derivatives market, which means that all the big banks and all the big hedge funds virtually are placing bets on interest rates. And half of those bets are that interest rates will be stable or go down from here. So let those bets go bad, and you'll see a lot of hedge funds blow up, and you'll see that reverberate through the financial system and maybe pull down some big banks. You know, there are all kinds of scenarios in which the extreme debt that we've taken on and the extreme level of financial speculation that has been going on come back to bite us. And housing is one possible place, but it's not the only place, and it's not the most likely place for that to happen right now. There's just so much that can happen that there's really no way to predict, because there are 8 big black swans out there waiting to land, and there's no way to know which one lands first. And when one of them happens, we're so fragile and so over-leveraged that it can cause a cascade failure of other sectors in the economy. So I don't know. If you ask me for one single word to describe what I see in the next few years, it's chaos. You know, something bad happens, it causes other bad things to happen, and then things spin out of control. And it all comes back to the fact that we borrowed way too much money. You know, nothing theoretical, nothing mystical, magical about any of this, but when you borrow too much money, your life begins to suck. And that's where we are now as a society.
That's quite frank. I mean, that's exactly what it is. Well, your book was called, you know, The Coming Collapse of the Dollar and How to Profit from It. And I think that last half, given the fact that you said there's these 8 black swans and certainly there's going to be chaos in the future, what do you tell people? I mean, how is there one single thing that people can do, that everyone can do, that would help them? What do you recommend?
Well, you want to avoid being dependent on fiat currencies for your income as much as possible. And that means don't be buying long-term bonds that give you a steady stream of dollars or yen or euros or any of the other big currencies, because the only possible reaction for governments to the kind of things that are coming will be to try to depreciate their currencies in order to make their debts less onerous. And if they depreciate their currencies, that means the income stream that you get from fixed financial instruments like bonds goes down in value also. So that's one thing to do. You know, if you've got bond funds in your 401k or whatever, get out of them. get into something that doesn't depend on dollars. And historically, precious metals have been that safe haven. You know, when things have spun out of control in terms of currencies, the hundreds of times in history that has happened, the one thing that we go back to is gold and silver, because those are forms of money that can't be created in infinite quantities by governments, and therefore their supply is limited and they hold their value. And you can go, you know, from the Roman Empire through the China's first experiment with paper money, through the French Revolution, through the U.S. Revolution, and in each case, paper money went basically to zero, or copper in case of the Roman Empire. But anyhow, stuff that you could make in infinite quantities were created in infinite quantities. They went to their intrinsic value, which is zero or close to that, and gold and silver held their value. So precious metals are another place to hide out. And then, well-chosen real estate, because it's real. You know, you can't create more farmland, or you can't create more beachfront property. And therefore, those things tend to hold their value in times of currency stress. So there are lots of things you can do. And if you're really aggressive, you can bet against the financial sector by shorting the big banks and the home builders and the mortgage lenders and companies like that. That was a phenomenally successful strategy if you timed it right in the middle of the last decade. You know, if you did it in 2004, you got creamed, but if you did it in 2007, you made a lifetime's worth of money. And a lot of people did that. A lot of the big hedge fund fortunes are guys who are household names right now. Made big chunks of their fortune by betting against the housing market in the last housing bubble. So the same thing is probably possible again on a somewhat smaller scale, but I think by betting against the financial markets right now, you probably are on the right side of history.
You brought up gold and silver, and it's been really interesting to see where they have been over the last several weeks, as they have really begun a brand new breakout and a new rally, which has been inspiring, I think, for many of us who have been holding gold and silver and sitting through some of these doldrums of the summer that we typically sit through. But what's been very interesting is that both gold silver and gold and silver mining companies are bucking the overall weakness in the markets, and they're rising higher. What's your thoughts on what's happening in gold and silver? What's causing this uptick now, and why did it take so long?
Well, the bear market in gold and silver was so sudden and so dramatic that we should expect, other things being equal, nothing else going on in the world, we should expect a technical bounce from here. And that it could be just that. It could just be that these things got crushed, and now it's time for them to bounce a bit. But it could also be a couple of other things. One is that the precious metals markets see what's going on out there, and they see 3 months or 6 months down the road the government having to take back its tapering talk and just reassure the markets by saying that there's going to be a flood of newly created currency flowing into the banking system for as far as the eye can see. That's phenomenally good for precious metals. And so the gold and silver markets could be anticipating that. Also, you're seeing massive demand for precious metals, especially gold, but also silver in Asia. They're basically vacuuming up all the available precious metals out there. And that's partially cultural for them. They've always been big buyers of precious metals. And the fact that it's ramping up from here could be part of an overall strategy in which the developed world accumulates a lot of precious metals and then eventually wants to back their currency with precious metals as a way of supplanting the dollar as the world's reserve currency. That's also quite possible, very feasible, and it could be what's going on, and that could be part of the reason that gold and silver are going up. And the final reason is that precious metals just should be a lot higher than this. If you look at the amount of paper currency and the electronic equivalent that's been created in the last 30 years, the imbalance is insane. You would need gold at $5,000 an ounce to be able to balance out the amount of paper that's being created out there. So gold really should be several thousand dollars an ounce. And the fact that it's not is in part due to people's not quite understanding this yet, and in part due to active, blatant manipulation on the part of the world's central banks and the big bullion banks that work for them in the market. So the paper markets are being used to force down the price of precious metals and can continue for a while to be used that way. But at some point, the amount of physical gold and silver that are being taken out of the market will leave supplies so sparse that the physical side of the market will overrun the paper side, and it'll make it impossible to manipulate the gold and silver markets using futures contracts. And at that point, all bets are off. You'll see gold and silver go to their intrinsic value in terms of the amount of paper that's out there, which will be several thousand dollars for gold, several hundred dollars for silver, and $20 silver and $1,200 gold will just be a distant memory.
You are a Liberty guy, and I'm looking at your website right now, dollarcollapse.com, and you keep track of war, civil unrest, privacy, creeping fascism, police state headlines. I'm looking at your website right now and seeing this. And you obviously saw the same headline that I saw just about 24 hours ago whenever Google said, of course Gmail users cannot expect privacy when sending emails through our service. Now, it seems as if, John, if that headline had come out pre-Edward Snowden, if it had come out pre-NSA revelations, that would have caused a lot of people concern. There would have been talk about, do we need to switch from Gmail and try to find a different kind of email service? You know, we need to protect our privacy. But now, in this huge, noisy world that we live in with all of these NSA revelations and cover-ups in the government, you know, Google coming out and saying, yeah, of course your Gmail's not safe, it just doesn't seem to have any kind of effect. It's almost as I doubt, you know, Gmail is going to lose too many subscribers out of that whole issue. What are you making of this NSA gate that we see and the absolute depth of corruption that exists in Washington? I want you to speak to that for a minute because I know you're a Liberty guy and I'm sure you have some thoughts on it.
Sure. Well, the most important lesson of history, at least from a libertarian's point of view, is that power corrupts. If you give excessive amounts of power to any one person or any group of people, even if they start out as philosopher princes, you know, just enlightened guys who want to do the right thing, they will eventually be corrupted by that power, or their successors will. And that we're seeing the result of that now. The federal government has gotten more and more powerful over the last 30 or 40 years, and it's really reached a tipping point where they consider themselves to be absolutely immune to public scrutiny. They can do anything they want to do and get away with it. And so they're doing it because they, at the same time, they've developed the technologies to allow them to do things that has never been possible before. So we've got this confluence of a big, powerful government and extraordinary telecommunications surveillance technology. And so it shouldn't be a surprise that the guys in charge are trying to use this stuff to the fullest extent, and then they're getting away with it. So we now have the ability to basically vacuum up every single electronic communication that happens in the U.S., store it, and then data mine it, and then trace it back over however many years the database goes back to find out pretty much everything about the average citizen. And all of this, from beginning to end, would have been unconstitutional under the old framework, where you had to get a warrant in order to eavesdrop on someone. But they've thrown that out the window. So we've created the infrastructure for a high-tech Big Brother police state. And the question is, when does the switch get flipped to where they start using it in a really blatant way and just picking up citizens and locking them up with impunity? And, you know, that's the kind of thing that is the logical conclusion to what's happening. And it should be terrifying to everybody because, you know, if you look at the elections of the past 50 years, without me naming names and antagonizing various political groups out there, we've elected some guys who had very questionable character. And even assuming that the people in charge now are basically good-hearted and honestly trying to do the right thing, eventually we're going to elect a would-be dictator. And they're going to find the infrastructure in place for a very, very pervasive, very powerful dictatorship just ready to be flipped on. And, you know, it terrifies me. I don't see a real solution. People are starting to pick up on that it's happening, but there isn't enough pushback right now to actually roll back any of this stuff. Every once in a while, the government will say, oh, never mind, we won't do that after all. But you know, behind the scenes, they're going to keep on doing it, and they're going to hope they don't get caught, but they'll find a way to justify it if they do get caught.
That's like the CIA MK Ultra. They said, oh, yeah, we stopped that. We're not doing mind control experiments anymore. And, of course, mm-hmm. they get busted and find out that they are. Well, one of the things that I'm concerned about is that right now Americans don't seem to mind being databased and traced and tracked and, you know, like cattle with all the technology. It seems as if they do want to push back, but they feel powerless. You know, they look at themselves and say, we're only 330 million people. How in the world could we possibly have any control over the 300, 400, 500 men in Washington? You know, and so it's one of these strange paradoxes where the masses find themselves completely powerless in the hands of such a corrupt inner circle of people who are doing this. Now, when we think about how this plays out, I want to get your take on this, because we are already seeing blowback in the form of cut defense contracts. For example, Brazil. We didn't need another enemy in our hemisphere. And we certainly didn't need one, you know, just so close to us in Brazil. But Brazil, whenever Secretary of State John Kerry went down to talk and do his normal state visit, all they wanted to talk about in Brazil was the NSA. Why are you spying on us? How long have you been spying on us? When are you going to stop spying on us? What did you find out? What did you get? What are the details? And Kerry had no answers at all. And they said, well, we're going to, you know, probably cut our $4 billion defense contract that we have with you. So we really haven't seen this whole NSA Edward Snowden work itself out in the local elections across the world. We could see a strong backlash and blowback from even our current allies. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Everybody is worried about this. They see us becoming a global dictator, even more so than they'd seen us as that before. And one of the ways this is manifesting is the recognition out there that the fact that we have the world's reserve currency gives does essentially a blank check to fund all of this stuff. You know, our military budget dwarfs the next 10 military budgets in the world. Our surveillance and technology budget, our cyber war technology budget, dwarfs anybody else's. And so I think they're going to hit back at the source of this power, which is the dollar. So one of the reasons that the developing world is vacuuming up so much gold and silver is that that gives them the ability to, and cutting all kinds of bilateral trade deals where they use their own currencies rather than having to switch into dollars and back out again in order to buy oil and food and things like that. So over time, and it won't be a lot of time necessarily, you'll see the rest of the world break free of dollar hegemony and start using their own currencies, and other reserve currencies start to bubble up, and that will limit the power of the U.S. to fund a global military empire and impose its will on everybody else. So I think they can't confront us directly economically right now, and certainly not directly militarily, but they can get at the root of our power, which is the dollar. And so that's part of the currency war scenario, where other countries are going to begin to do things to weaken the control of the dollar over the global economy and the dollar's role in the global economy. And it'll begin with China, but Brazil and Russia will be active participants. And when it happens, it will force us to live within our means, and in that way force us to scale back our global military power. So, you know, it's a long-term strategy, but not that long-term. It could happen in the coming decade.
I think it's funny that we see a lot of the Republicans today as they're gearing up for 2016, and I can't even stomach the thought of having to sit through another, you know, Jeb Bush versus Hillary Clinton whole saga, as I just can't imagine a Bush versus Clinton ticket, which I mean, at some point you want to know, where does the train stop? Where do I get off? You know, at some point you want out. And it seems as if, though, Rand Paul has been gaining a lot of traction among some people who you and I would probably view as neocons. Are you surprised to see some of the Republicans beginning to finally see the light of the logic put forth by the likes of Rand Paul, who happens to be, by the way, the son of the some guy that was on the stage in 2008 and 2012 who was talking about ending the Fed and stopping the wars of Ron Paul, that was his name. Any thoughts on the coming wave that we see towards Rand Paul, and is he a Trojan horse? Would you vote for Rand Paul?
You know, he's kind of a beginner. He hasn't been out there for very long, and I don't know that his ideas are fully formed enough for me to actually commit to voting for him. You know, Ron Paul has been saying the same thing for 30 years, and he's very coherent. Rand Paul is starting to say a lot of interesting stuff, and he's definitely on the right side of these national security issues. But I think libertarians have a broad appeal, but not nearly broad enough to actually get elected to national office, because if Rand Paul pursued policies that you and I would agree with, Jerry, I think he would alienate so many people who depend on the government for various things that he would end up getting not much more than his dad's level of vote, which is 5 or 10% in major national elections. So right now, the fact that he's coming out against government spying and the encroachment of the federal government on our what we used to think of as our civil rights, it gives him a lot of appeal. But as soon as he gets a national forum and starts talking about economic issues and scaling back the welfare state and things like that, then he loses an awful lot of people. And so I don't see Rand Paul as the solution, because I don't see him being able to get more than 15 or 20% at the most in any kind of national election. And even if he did do well in primaries, it would be because the Republicans don't want the Democrats to have the kind of power that the Republicans would want when they got into office. You know, both of these parties abhor the abuses while they're out of office and then embrace them while they're in office. And so for the Republicans to take over they would then want a super powerful police state because it would be their police state. They would be able to do anything they wanted to with it. And so to run a guy who would literally actively scale back the power of that police state wouldn't be seen as in the Republicans' interest either. You know, they want to win, but they want to win and then inherit...
On their terms, yeah.
Yeah, they want to inherit a big, powerful government. They don't want to win and then scale back this government because that's their power then. So libertarians are they're an important movement, and they're definitely fun to listen to. But the way the system is set up now, they don't have a chance of actually accomplishing anything at the national level, I'm afraid. You know, we need a consensus to form that has not yet formed before the libertarians can actually be a real power at a national level.
One person once told me, he said, the only thing that a politician sees wrong with the world is that he's not running it. And I think that's really true when you think about it. It's oftentimes these guys who are running, they want to get in power, and then they don't really change much of what they had promised to change. And I'm thinking about the upcoming debt ceiling debate, which is going to, again, be ad nauseum. We're going to see it on the television and in the news. And, of course, you're a news guy, so you're following all this, and you're going to see all the headlines. And the Republicans are going to be hem-hawing about how terrible the debt ceiling increase is. But as you pointed out, in 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, it was the best thing in the world to raise the debt ceiling. But you know, to the Republicans. But all of a sudden in 2008, 2009, when Obama got in, holy cow, we've got to stop raising the debt ceiling. You know, it's just terrible. It's atrocious. He wants to spend us into oblivion. Well, this is the year that a Democrat runs the White House and they run the Senate. Therefore, we need to be against the debt ceiling increase, thus says the Republicans. Final question before I let you go. You're an internet guy. You're an internet entrepreneur. You run dollarcollapse.com. I run ftmdaily.com. We watch a lot of our traffic. We see where it's coming from. And we've been talking a lot about the NSA. We've been talking a lot about a lot of the encroachment upon our civil rights. And we've been somewhat bold about it as of late. And I have noticed that we have been getting intermittent knockouts of our website, and we've also been getting a huge amount of traffic. I mean, if you look at it on a chart, the way we have it with our Google analytics, we're getting a massive amount of traffic now from Washington, D.C., which was not the case just, you know, maybe 3 months ago. Washington, D.C. was not a big player on our list. New York was big, but not Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. is now our number one area that reads our website. I don't find that to be a coincidence since we've changed our emphasis with the NSA. I'm curious, are you concerned about your website going offline? Are you concerned about this encroachment coming down the pike and actually impacting people like you and me who are trying to get the truth out?
Oh, yeah. I think that's going to be a feature of the conflict over how much power the government has in the future as there is more pushback and more of the abuses of what used to be our Bill of Rights privacy protections. We'll see a lot of response to that. And one of the ways they'll respond is by using their cyber war capabilities that they're developing right now. You know, they totally have the ability to shut down any website they want to anytime and just keep it down. And I've no doubt they will use that selectively in the future. And again, I'm not sure what we can do about that because, you know, you and I both have webmasters and everything, and it's their job to get us back up when a site goes down. But a serious attack by military-grade, sophisticated hackers would be more than we could handle.
Sure.
And so, I'm sure that's part of the landscape out there somewhere.
Yeah,
and I don't know that what I'm doing is big enough to really warrant anyone's attention just yet, or much attention just yet, because there are some bigger, more active voices out there that would probably be more logical candidates to go after. But it wouldn't be a surprise to see something like that start happening, or to see it happening already, and we just don't sit back to Washington yet. I don't know. You know, so much stuff can happen when a government goes bad that it's really hard to predict the details and the particulars of but you know that power, once it's in the hands of people who have been corrupted by it, isn't let go of easily and is frequently used in ways that really shock the people who aren't used to it. So we could easily see all of this stuff and more in the future before we sort this out.
My guest today, John Rubino, dollarcollapse.com. He is the founder of that and editor of that website, a daily news aggregation service that brings together lots of great news on the economy and on personal liberty. John, why don't you tell our folks how they can find your book and some of the different things that you do so they can connect with you?
Sure. The easiest way is to go to dollarcollapse.com. And the book that James Turk and I co-wrote, which is still, you know, it's got some charts that show lower numbers in it than prevail today, but otherwise the story is still the same. It's the collapse of the dollar and how to profit from it, and it's available on Amazon and also at dollarcollapse.com.
Fantastic. Well, as always, it's great to have you on the program. We'll have you back on soon.
Great, Jerry. Look forward to it.